we're dealing with this morning is why is it so important all the areas of ethics? By ethics, I mean making correct decisions in life, how to live everyday life, how to make a plan or a strategy, which is all part of Torah, how to deal with our emotions that affect our decision-making where we make an incorrect decision in life. Why is this area so important to religion? The essence of religion should be God, and that should come first. But yet by us, the area that comes first is the how to live the correct life, getting rid of bad emotions that affect our thinking, how we think. You understand? All these things. The question is why is this part of religion, and it's such an important part of religion? In fact, you don't find it in any other religion except in Judaism. Question is, why is it so important? Definitely we should live by these ideas because God told us and the Torah told us. But however, what we want to understand is why did God tell us? What is so important? What does this have to do with religion? We want to understand why God made it a basics of religion. In fact, the Ralbach says, this is the beginning of all our studies of Torah. The basic beginnings is this area. So the question is why is it so basic? Basics of religion should be my relationship to God. And the question is that if we're supposed to obey God, and God told us that we should live the moral and ethical life and make correct decisions in everyday life, so therefore we should just obey God. That's why it's part of religion, because when we do it, we're obeying God. And so therefore that's what it has to do with religion. The answer is, there is no question that we must obey God. But we do have the right, and we have a great benefit in seeing why God does these things. We should be able to see how these things work and why it works. You see, we have the right to do that. In fact, throughout the commentaries, they always try to find the reasons for the different mitzvos, even though they keep you have to keep the mitzvos, whether you have the answer or whether you don't have the answer, you must keep the mitzvos. Okay, the thing is, we do have the right and the ability to see and understand why God set it up in this form, and that will help us to relate to the idea better, and it will help us to relate to God better, because when we see God, when we understand God's wisdom, so it helps us to relate to God better. So therefore, what our question is, yes, we accept that this must be the best thing for man. But however, the question still is, how is it the best for man? Why is this the best introduction to religion and our relationship to God? In other words, we have the right to ask anything in the Torah, how God relates to us and why he relates to us. That is a valid question. And I might not have the answer. Sometimes even our sages don't have the answers for certain particular questions. But however, they accept the premise that the question is a good question, and there has to be a search to find the answer. The only type of question which you cannot answer is once you prove that the answer to the question is based on God's nature. It's based on God. Once it's based on God, since we cannot know who God is, so that once we prove that, that is the answer to our question, that it's knowledge that we cannot know. That is, once we prove that it's knowledge that we cannot know, that should end the quest for that type of knowledge, because we cannot know it. But however, when it comes to how God relates to us, which is for our benefit, so therefore we should be able to see the benefit in the way God relates to us, that it is a benefit to us and for us. Judaism, the ultimate relationship to God in Judaism is through knowledge. It's not based on a feeling that there is a God and that I relate to that God. It's based on that I must know that there is a God. I'm talking about knowledge of God, that God exists, that God relates to me. It's based on that I must know this, not just believe it. See, we know that when a person is born a Jew, that is just the beginning. That's just a good situation to see the truth. But ultimately, that's a good situation to get started by being raised in a Jewish home. It's a benefit. But ultimately, I have to make the decision that I'm going to stick with Judaism because I see that it is true, and it's the best, that it is true that it was given by God, and that it's the best possible life for a human to live. That's where a person must reach. But you shouldn't stay in the city. You can't just stay and say, well, I was born Jewish, therefore I'm Jewish. Because then there are people born in idolatry, they could say, well, I was born into idolatry, so therefore I'm an idolater. It's not an excuse to be born into an idolatry. You're still an idolater. Okay? The same thing when you're born Jewish, that has nothing to do with you. You just happen to be born that way. But then at a certain point, you should step back and say, just one minute, now let me see if it's true. We are trained from youth on that when we cross the street, we should look both ways. Or we shouldn't walk into the gutter without a parent. Okay? Now, we don't know the reason why, but the only reason why we do it is because our parents tell us to, right? But however, at a certain point, when you're 15, 20 years old, I hope the reason why you look both ways and careful in the street is not because of your parents, but because you know reality. If it's still because of your parents, you're in trouble. You didn't develop. Now, the same thing here. When you're born in Judaism, so you do it because you were raised that way. But we hope that you don't stay in that situation. We hope at a certain point you stop to think about and find that this is the truth. And that's why you stick to it, not because you were raised that way. The question is that if a person is raised Jewishly, why should he have to keep the mitzvahs anyway? Because he's doing it for the wrong reason. Okay? Now, again, when you could look both ways to cross the street because of your parents, so you don't step into the street because of your parents. I mean, you're doing it for the wrong reason, right? Now, should the parent let you just walk in the street because you're doing it for the wrong reason? Or should you always train for the wrong reason to do the right thing and be trained that way, and then later all you have to do is change your motive? Why are you doing it? That's why a person that starts out not in a religious home and has to repent, he tasted all the desires. For him, it's a long trip. It's a very hard thing. And he has to change from not living in reality to live in reality. Person that's raised this way, at least he's living in reality, but for the wrong reason. So therefore, it's the same type of situation. And the question is, it's not like crossing the street because you see, let's say, for instance, if a person eats treif, non-kosher, a Jewish person who doesn't eat kosher, he's violating the law. But however, non-Jew, you see the same thing, he eats treif meat, non-kosher meat, and he's doing absolutely nothing wrong, and he could, even if he studies Torah and keep the seven mitzvahs of the Nei Noach, he'd have a portion in the world to come with him eating non-kosher food. So you see that it's not equal to reality because it's not equal to all people. That is the question. The answer is that there are two ways that we know reality. One reality is that we know through our five senses. That is a reality. Okay? There's another reality that we know, that it is reality by virtue that God said that it's a reality. Why? Because since God is the source of all reality, so anything that God says is real. Okay? Now, when God says that the Jews must keep 613 mitzvahs, that becomes a reality for the Jew. Okay? Okay, but not for the non-Jew. Like for instance, let's say for instance a fire truck. He doesn't have to obey certain traffic signs. He could go through a full stop. He could go through a red light. I don't have that right. Okay, but that is because the reality for him is different than the reality for me. Okay. But here also the reality for the Jew is different than for the non-Jew. And the reason why is by virtue that God said that it is true. Therefore, since God is the source of all reality, that makes it a reality. And therefore, if I don't keep treif, then I'm violating a reality. No different than any other reality. So therefore, a person starts out relating to reality in an incorrect manner. The child, because he obeys reality because of his parents. In Torah, he obeys reality because God said so, or also because of his parents, or he has some other incorrect view. But then he finds out the truth, that he must keep it because of God, and then he tries to understand the benefits of why God told him all these things, since it's a benefit to him, just like the child at a certain point realizes that he might hate a dentist, but then he realizes that the dentist is being nice to him. So even though he's in pain, he causes him pain, but he's really being a nice person by helping him and preventing him from losing his teeth or from any other diseases of the mouth. So the thing is that as a child we might look and hate this doctor or dentist because he hurts us, but then we see the benefit and we're happy with it. Now the same thing when we start out with relating to religion, we keep it because of our parents, because we feel we were raised that way. But however, at a certain point, we must make a decision of that this was really given to us by God, and then after I see that it was given to us by God, then I have a right to see how it benefits me so that I could see why God gave it to me. And therefore, I see God's wisdom in all of everything that God does, because I see that He gave me commandments, and he gave me studies and ideas that benefit my life. Not only benefit, but it gives me the best possible life that a human being could have in the physical world. So therefore, what we're asking now is, why did God give the ethics? Everything that has to do with everyday life, it's true, it's a very good life. I see why life without jealousy, without vengeance is good. I see why strategy and planning in life is good. I see all these making decisions, how to make decisions. I mean, I see it's a good, the benefit. But we still don't, we're asking a different question. The question is, what does it have to do with religion? Religion has to do with God. What does this have to do with God? That is the question which we're asking now. Right. The answer is that our basic relationship with God is a rational relationship. It's not based on a a belief system. It's based on knowing that there is a God. Okay? Now, we hold that rationally, you person can know God. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see God in the universe. I mean, of course, you could get very abstract in religion and be as high as Maimonides and the prophets. I mean, all these great people, and you could study religion and see abstract ideas there. But in the basics, if you're not an abstract thinker, still in all, you could find God from the everyday life. You could find God. What is the difficulty in finding God? It's not the rationale. It's not very abstract, and most people can get the basics without very abstract. The difficulty is the emotions. Our emotions affect our thinking process. I'll give you an example. When your best friend or somebody you love, even a parent, if they scream and yell at you, or they punish you, they take away something you really want to do or have, at that moment, they could be the worst people in the world. 5 minutes later, they do something and they're the most wonderful person in the world. Right? They're the best parents a human being could ever have. Two, which one is right? You see? But the emotions force you to look at it in a ultimate, either depending on what mood you're in, to look at your parents that way. The truth is, there are very few Hitlers in the world, and there's very few Moshes in the world. The two extremes. Most human beings have certain good qualities, and they have certain bad qualities. Okay? Everybody has something good and bad about them. So sometimes they might, sometimes they might have bad qualities, and you should be honest to recognize it, to recognize that they have weak qualities, but they also have good qualities. You also should realize that sometimes when they're doing something good for you, you don't see it as a good. And it's not that they're bad parents, they're really good parents. And sometimes they might do something nice for you, which really they shouldn't. That is not the good thing, to be soft on you, but to be tough on you. So, and sometimes when you think they're being nice to you, they're really being very harmful because they're training you to be lazy or not to do the correct thing. So therefore, these are all based on your emotions. In other words, your emotions make you look at life incorrectly, and what's a good you look at it as a bad, what's a bad you look at it as a good. Now, since God is, when you accept God, you are taking on an unbelievable responsibility, there are powerful emotions not to relate to God. There's also religious emotions, very powerful emotions, that make you want to relate to God, but not in the correct manner, but according to the way I feel about relating to God. So that's the way I want to relate to God. So these both extremes, whether you have religious emotions or non-religious emotions, are very powerful emotions, and they make you look at God incorrectly. Okay? And since you must find God in an intelligent way, in an intelligent manner with ideas, so the first thing you must do is deal with those emotions that affect the way you, that affect your thinking process, the way you think. So since we have to find God not through our feelings, not through our emotions, but find God with through our mind, so therefore, we must learn to deal with our emotions. And the best and simplest place to do with it is everyday life. Decisions in everyday life is not an abstract study. It's not very abstract, it's simple ideas. But the difficulty in making correct decisions, our emotions, like I showed you, even the way we think about what is a good parent and what is a bad parent. I mean, we make mistakes about that. You understand, when a parent punishes us, we think he's bad, when really it might be good. Parent gives us a reward, you think it's a good, when maybe it's a bad. You just don't know. You have to stop to think about it. You can't make decisions based on the way you feel. You can't base decisions on a doctor because he speaks nicely to you and he's comforting. You have to know who he is as a doctor. You can't go by bedside manners. In all the decisions in all areas, you must know clearly. And the same thing with your parents. Your parents have good points, like any other human being. They have good points and bad points. You have to be objective about it and know in any human being, even in friends. You have to be able to see both sides. Okay? So therefore, where you make errors in these things, you have to know that it's an emotion that is causing you to make errors. Because the ideas are not very difficult. And any person, if it wasn't for their emotions, everybody would know exactly what to do. Be no problem. But the only problem is our emotions make us see life incorrectly. And therefore, we must start with the simplest area, with the beginning area to deal with our emotions, where the best possible life is the life of thought, where you plan it and think it through, and yet people don't do it. You see? So therefore, why don't they do it? Because it's easier just to give in to their emotions, even though it is harmful. Right, the question is, what would be life without emotions? I mean, it'd be totally boring. If you didn't have emotions, life would be boring. The answer to that question is that you cannot get rid of emotions. That's part of a human being. Emotions. But the only thing is the question is, what place does emotions should take in your life? When you start out in life, emotions make decisions for you. Okay? Like jealousy, greed, competition. These emotions make decisions for you. But however, we say that what should make the decisions for you is the mind. But not that you don't have emotions. You do have emotions. Like, for instance, there was a prophet that came in the presence of an evil person, and he got so angry and upset that he couldn't get prophecy. You can't get prophecy when you're very angry. So he asked for a guitar for music so that they should calm him down so he could receive prophecy. So you see, he has emotions, but his emotions are based on his view of life. In other words, he relates to people. He has a feeling of love for people. But however, his love for people comes through an identification of people who have the same morals and ethics and ideas. You see? So then he has an identification with them. He has a certain feeling of love for them, not by psychological identification. So therefore, yes, he has emotions, and his emotions are very strong and powerful. But however, his emotions are changed through your knowledge. You channel your emotions that they follow the world of ideas, that follow the world of ideas, and then you have those emotions. And yes, you enjoy the physical world. You can still enjoy the physical world. The only thing is that you'll enjoy it where it's not harmful and where it doesn't take you away from religion. And it doesn't take you away from God. So, of course, you could enjoy the physical world. So he also has an enjoyment for the physical world. It's not that he's not emotional. It's what he gets emotional about that is different. In other words, psychologically, the psychological emotions that come as a result of your psychological, your personality, so that causes you unhappiness and causes you to make incorrect decisions. but emotions as a result, that's a good thing, okay? And that you have the right to enjoy. Okay, the question is God seems to be unfair in the sense that he forces me to become Jewish before I understand why I should be Jewish, and therefore I really don't like the mitzvos, and why does God do this? And there seems to be many, many questions like that today about God. I'd like to give a general approach to this problem. If we accept that there is a God and God created the world, if you look around the whole world, you see that everything is perfect in the world, has a certain order and abstractness and complexity that only a God can bring about. However, it seems to be in general that somehow there is a mistake insofar as humans are concerned, how God relates to humans. It seems to be unfair, you see. That is really the problem. Is because the way God relates to humans, you don't see the order that you see in the universe. In other areas of science, you don't see that same order, you don't see the same depth. On the contrary, it seems to be a lot of confusion. Okay? So the first step that you have to understand is that God created one species with free will. Okay? Free will means I have the right and I have a view, an incorrect view of life. Okay? And I must make a decision between my mind and my emotions. My emotions has an incorrect view of life, while my mind has a correct view of life. Because of that, there came out a tremendous amount of problems because people make their decisions based on their emotions, and the whole thing is that evil came out. Things came about that are totally confusing. There's no order there. That is where the disorder came about. Now the problem is that every one of these questions that you have against God's justice must be investigated in the particulars and to see how it is. We can't answer it in one second, in one day. Some of them we have to work on, some of them we won't have the answers. We don't even have the answers. I mean, there are great people that do, but I don't, you see. But however, you must know that because God wanted one species of animal to have free will, and the only way he could do that is create two parts to the human being, one that sees life correctly and one that sees life incorrectly, you see. Therefore, there came out a terrible confusion among human beings because people are making decisions based on this incorrect view of life. So it seems to be that there's a tremendous amount of confusion that where's God's fairness, where's his order, where's his ideas, where's his truth, where's the system, doesn't seem to be in human affairs. That is a big problem, and it puts people off. Big questions that people have. But however, you have to understand the same God that created the universe created the human being. And in every area you see the order and complexity and depth and ideas and the depth of ideas in all these sciences. You have to know that there is an order in human beings. Even in the area that the human beings make mistakes, there is a certain type of order there. And that order you have to find it. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand these ideas. These are not very abstract ideas. Most of them are not as abstract as physics. and the human being could find them. The problem is our emotions don't allow us to see it. And therefore, all these questions can be answered one at a time. They can be answered, but the first thing is that you have to have an overall view that the confusion in human beings and the whole system of the way humans operate is based because God wanted one species to have free will. And part of that means that a person has the ability to look at life totally incorrectly and make decisions on that incorrectness. And therefore, based on that, there seems to be a tremendous amount of confusion and a tremendous amount of questions. And all the area must be analyzed in the particulars, but this is just in general how to approach the subject. I'd like to give an overview of Kohelet, the Ecclesiastes. We're going to do chapter 1, verse 4. It says, a generation goes and a generation comes, and the land stands forever. Now Rashi doesn't explain it according to the simple meaning. He gives it like a midrashic interpretation of the verse. And in this, it says the earth stands forever. He says, and who are those that cause it to endure, to make the earth endure? That's the humble, or people with humility, that are very low, and they bring themselves down to the earth. They make themselves as low as the earth. They bring themselves, like it says in the passage, and the humble will inherit the earth. Okay? Now Rashi has a second interpretation, and that he mentions the Medrash Tanchuma, which says that all the righteous of Israel are called Eretz. The righteous of Israel are called land. In a Midrashic interpretation, it's not simple. It's not the simple, plain meaning of the pasuk, but it's a Midrashic interpretation, because it says, because you are like the earth, the desirable land. Okay, that you are like desirable land, and he's talking about the righteous of Israel. So the question is what is Rashi talking about, and what are the two explanations in Rashi? The first question that we must ask is, what is humble, or what is humility? Okay? The first possibility is that they don't make themselves, a humble person they're not so self-centered that they cannot think of other people, okay? Now, you have to be careful when you interpret it. There are certain people that by nature are not self-centered. The Torah would not define that as humility or humble, okay? In other words, the Torah would not say, the Torah will say that not self-focused, is a quality of humility, but it's not the essence of humility. It's not the essence. Okay? I'm going to give a definition of humility, but I know that it has to be explained. Humility means where a person could see reality correctly. Okay? I'll explain what I mean. There are certain times, like let's say for instance, there are certain people, they love their parents very much. However, let's say their parents punish them. Have terrible punishment, and they can't go to the movies with their friends, and all their friends are going. This is a catastrophe. And at that moment, they're the worst parents that exist. Okay? Now, before, just 10 minutes ago, they were the best parents. Now, suddenly, they're the worst. Now, only one of these could be true. But the thing is that the emotions affect you in such a way that it doesn't let you think clearly. Humility means that I'm able to look at the world totally correctly without any emotion affecting me. Okay? It's been mentioned here that that sometimes a person has a big ego, but he acts as with humility, okay? You have to understand that there are people that there is a certain humility which is acceptable to society. That's not the humility what we're talking about. There's a certain humility that you know in society there's a certain way of talking. A person doesn't brag about himself. He might feel that he is the best, you see? He might feel bigger than you, you see? But he would not say it because it's not acceptable by society. That is what society calls humility. We don't say that. We say humility is I accept my place in the world, that I know exactly, and I'm not affected by my emotions. Okay? And I know exactly where I fit in the world insofar as my relationship to people and insofar as my relationship to God. I know exactly who and what I am in that relationship. Humility is a certain type of view of the world, how you look at the world and how you look at yourself in relationship to the world. That is humility. Humility is a certain view. I'll try and clarify it, what that view is, but it's a certain view of the world. It has nothing to do with what you could do, whether you have talents or you don't have talents. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with a certain view of reality of the world. Okay? There are two areas, both are emotions, that affect your thinking process. One area is addictions, things that I have to do, I must do. For instance, I have to talk Lashon Hara. By the way, I'm using the word addiction not like the society uses it, but I'm broadening it out where I must do something, even though it's acceptable by society, but I am forced to do it. I can't control myself. That is an addiction. Like, for instance, jealousy, anger, all these things where it just comes, I have, it's true, it's human nature that people are born with these things. I understand that. But however, the thing is, I'm calling that an addiction, and according to Torah, the human being can undo these type of addictions. And also, the opposite of that is there's certain things I can't do. There's certain things that you can't do. The Torah, in other words, it's going to force you to think of life in an incorrect way. And therefore, all these things which I'm forced to do by an addiction, or I can't do because of a certain emotion that doesn't allow me to carry out, like there's certain people that can't put a worm on a hook. Right? It's disgusting, right? Right? To certain people, it's disgusting. That's something they can't do. It means that they have an incorrect view. There's something wrong there there's something that is, you should be able to do. Why? Fishing is an okay thing. In other words, it doesn't matter if what you think is gross or I think it's gross, if I think something is disgusting, there's nothing disgusting. Everything God created. And therefore, I just should look at it objectively. What is its purpose and how should I relate to it? You see? So therefore, it's like, in other words, like you use the term phobia, right? There's certain phobias. That is an incorrect view of life. Everybody is born with them. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with you if you have it. That would be a rarity of rarities if somebody didn't have any of these things. Everybody has it. The question is that every human being has a fault. It's true, everybody's born with faults. The way I'm defining faults, right? So every human being has it, and we don't have saints. And it would be a rarity of rarities if anybody undid all his faults, the way we're defining a fault, it would be a rarity of rarities for somebody to totally undo it. That happens to be correct. I agree with you, it is correct. But however, you are responsible to get as close to perfect yourself as possible. That's your responsibility. I understand you can't do the whole thing, but you are responsible to go according to your ability how much you could do. That is your responsibility to undo these faults, okay? In other words, that is really free will. If I would define free will, I would say God created a system within the human that the purpose of that system is to see the world incorrectly. That is what we mean by the emotions, like anger. Anger makes you, at that moment, hate your parents. But really, what your parents could be doing is a wonderful thing for you, but at that moment, you look at life incorrectly. Greed. Greed is an incorrect relationship, or stinginess is an incorrect relationship to money. So, therefore, there are certain incorrect relationships to the world that God created in the human being. That's how he created free will. Anyways, the reason why God created the emotions is because God wanted a being to be able to choose between right and wrong. So you have to have something within you to look at life incorrectly, yes, so that you can have free will. If I couldn't look at life incorrectly, there wouldn't be any free will. I have no choice. I must look at life correctly. I must do the correct thing. But to have free will, God must create something within you to look at life incorrectly, and another part of you to look at life correctly, so that you should have free will. All I can say is, for this hour discussion, it's possible for the human to correct his incorrect view of the world so that he could live correctly. But if he corrects it totally, the odds are against that. But each person is responsible to change it to the best of their ability and as far as they could go.
Their ability, as far as they could go.
That's all I say. Where we left off yesterday was that we said that there are two things. There are pleasure, there's pleasures, and there's addictions. Pleasures, there's nothing wrong with. The person could enjoy pleasures, as long as it's not against halacha. A person could enjoy all the pleasures of the physical world, but addictions affect you in a way that it affects your thinking process. It doesn't allow you to think correctly. And therefore, it causes you. And by addiction, we said we spread out the idea of addiction not only to the physical addictions like they have in America, but also addictions like lashon hara, jealousy, vengeance, where you are addicted to it. If you have an emotion, but you're not addicted to it, you could go contrary to that emotion. Having that emotion is not bad, but it's where you're addicted and you cannot move from it, and it affects your actions and it affects the way you think, so then that is a harmful thing. And when you remove that, that is humility. Okay? Humility is where I accept reality for what it is and not the way I'm driven based on my addictions and my fantasies. By fantasy, I mean that part of you of the emotions which bring about an addiction, which forces you to operate in a particular manner. The second explanation of Rashi is that besides dealing with your emotions, what also helps, in other words, there's two realities. One is like my everyday reality, how I relate to people, how I relate to myself, how I feel about myself, that you have to deal in the everyday practical reality to see how you operate. But then also, there's a way of getting above the emotions through the world of study. That's what it means, a tzaddik of Israel. How do you become a tzaddik in Israel? When you study about God, and you study the ideas of God, So then your emotions turn away towards the world of study. That's also a level of humility where you're not living the life of the emotions, but you live the life of ideas.
The question that was asked is that the makos, the whipping that the courts give according to Torah, seems to be primitive and just to hurt the person. What is the benefit of whipping a person? That's the question. So, if you want to say that it will affect your emotions and force you to do the right thing when you whip somebody, right? But then that is not a free will. In other words, you take away the person's free will, and the only reason why he doesn't do it is because fear of whipping. Is that correct? That can be true if you say, which is true, that the purpose of the court is just to maintain, make sure that society works correctly, but it is not there to cure you of any of the sin. It's not there to cure you, your soul, and the that which motivated you to do the answer is wrong. It is a logical reason why to punish. It does control society, and we do have to control society. But the question is it possible in any way to affect and somehow help your free will to make a free will decision? There are some people that have certain habits or addictions that are quite harmful to themselves. Like, for instance, smoking, overeating, physical, which causes physical problems, okay? Now, many times, these people just keep eating until something goes wrong. Now, by some people, when something goes wrong, when they really start realizing that they're sick, and it could cause tremendous amount of problems, that situation makes them change and change their habits, or at least force themselves to go against, even if they can't undo it, to force them to act against their addictions. And it's not always fear, but the fear allows you to see the reality. In other words, like this. When a person smokes, in our society, he definitely knows that smoking is harmful. From everything that's on TV, what he read, and everything, he knows that it's harmful. But however, so when a person smokes, so the reality of the harm is not there, because the desire to smoke is immediate. He feels the desire, but the knowledge of the harm is in the mind, and the mind is not strong enough to overcome that addiction. However, when he starts feeling the consequences of the addiction, at that point it becomes physical. He starts feeling the pain, so therefore it becomes real to him that he is harming himself, and therefore he should change his ways. Some people can't. Even the addiction is stronger than the physical proofs that he is harming himself. But it is possible that there are people that when they get the physical consequences, when they actually experience it, that's enough to overcome. It doesn't overcome the addiction, but it counters the addiction, and you're able to fight it. Okay? So therefore, pain has a place in helping you with your free will. In other words, where my mind is not strong enough to overcome my addiction, then the consequences might help me. Okay? Now, if a person knows that God gave the Torah, if he knows the consequences of his actions against Torah, okay, I'm not talking about a person that doesn't accept Torah. person that does accept God, but it's not real to him. The consequences are not real to him, so sometimes he violates or he overlooks certain halachos. Certain times he keeps, which is not too much of a conflict. There's a conflict. He does it. He does the avera, right? That person, when put in a situation of hardship, you see, like when God punishes us, puts us in exile or something like that, so then when you experience the physical harm, and if you recognize it's from God, that you must know, you see, then that could be enough to overcome that reality is enough to overcome the desire. Now, could be by whipping also, that whipping is just a situation, and in other words, if you do not know the reason, if you do not really hold that you did wrong, you just need a reality, so then the punishment will help. That'll stop you based on your conscience, so at least will protect society. But simultaneously, if you have the knowledge what you did wrong, but you don't experience the consequence to overcome the addiction, so therefore what the Torah does, it gives you a physical punishment that you experience, and that reality that you experience, and if you recognize this is coming because of the sin that you violated, so then that reality can help you overcome the addiction of whatever the sin is. The question is that we recognize that when it's a natural consequence, so that consequence could help you overcome the addiction. But however, when it's artificially placed, like given to by a human being to beat you, so then that, on the contrary, not only might it not help, it might awaken a certain rebellion against the person. It's not a natural thing, you see. That is true. It is possible. It is possible. But simultaneously, for a person that knows that he sinned and knows that these laws were made by God, it's true, it's being carried out by humans. And even where humans did make the law, like in other nations, where they do have the right to make laws and they have an obligation to make laws to protect society, that idea for the benefit of the whole, for the benefit of myself as a part of society, that reality could come through when you are punished, okay? Even if it's given over by a human being. In other words, I'm saying that you have to punish for the first reason, namely that we must protect society, and a fear of punishment that you must control the society. But I'm also saying that it is possible the situation, even where it's inflicted by the human, if a person recognizes the truth that this is a good, then the physical punishment can help him see reality. It's not only the fear, in many cases, I'm sure it's the fear, and that's what stops them, and that's not free will. But if you have, the mind sees the truth, but the mind is not strong enough to overcome the addiction, then the consequence, even if it's man-given, like by whipping, I say that in certain cases it would be strong enough to affect the mind and say to overcome the addiction. That, in other words, the reality of the consequence makes you realize the reality that justice is a good and I must keep justice for the laws of Torah. In other words, it can work if you have the reality, but the mind is not strong enough to overcome the addiction. So then you need the physical affliction or consequence to help you see reality enough to force yourself to go against the addiction. Certain times the addiction is so strong, even though You have the physical consequence, you still can't do it. So the reality is not strong enough. Okay? But it can help. And in that way, whipping can be a benefit to free will, besides the benefit to control society. Okay, Rabbi Shoftim Judges, chapter 6, verse 2. And it says that the Midianites, would come in and destroy the land. We were under the control of Midian, and they would come in and destroy the land just to torment us, not for any gain of their own, but to keep us subservient and keep us broken. Verse 2 says that that because of Midian, because of this situation, the children of Israel went up into the mountains and the caves, and they made strongholds, and they made windows in these places so that they could see and have light and be able to operate in these places. It was dark places because they had to hide from the Midianites, and they used to hide these places. Rabbi Gold says another possibility for the word Minhoros, which is translated as lights, it could be, he says, that there was a... it could be translated also as torches, and they when they would see the Midianites, they would set up torches and get people to run away, so they knew to hide, and it was a warning system to go to the mountains. But whichever one it is, the Rambam says that there's a lesson to be learned from this, and that is sometimes when you're in a very catastrophic situation, a person gives up hope. And he says there is very rarely a situation that you should give up hope, and there's always something that you should do, and you should go as far as is logically possible in that situation. Now, to do this, I think that the first thing that a person has to do is train their mind to make decisions in the situation. You can't just do this suddenly. Your personality is to quit when you're in a bad situation. You can't just change overnight. So therefore, when in everyday life, before such a situation happens, what you have to do is train yourself to make decisions in life. And then slowly but surely, when you start living this way, that you always consciously make a decision in life, so then if you get into this situation, then also you'd be able to make decisions even in that type of situation. They say during the Holocaust, there's a whole book, I didn't read it, but there's a book on questions that in the concentration camp, people asked rabbis that were there, questions of Jewish law, how to act. I remember one person asked a question like this. They had lines of people that they would line up to go to death. Okay? And this guy says, let's say I'm on the death line, and I could get off, I could sneak off, I could get away with it. Should I do it? Why? Because if I get away with it, then they have a certain amount of numbers, somebody else is going to take my place. Do I have the right to escape? According to Halacha, do I have the right to escape in such a situation where somebody else will take my place? Now, I don't know what the answer was, because, like I said, I didn't read the book. But, however, the idea that a person in that type of situation thinks rationally, one, about how to escape his particular situation, and two, halachically, according to law, whether he's allowed to do it, that's a person that has trained himself to make decisions in every aspect of life, that thinks through life. And it's just a natural thing when he's in this situation to continue thinking that way. But that takes a certain amount of training to do that, and you must start training now to think about making decisions so that if you're ever in such a situation, you'd be able to make rational decisions. Even though sometimes there is the story of Rabbi Akiva where they took them to kill him, and he didn't do anything because that situation there was no way out. But it shouldn't be giving up hope but it should be a conscious decision that I've analyzed the situation and there is no way out and I can't escape, and so therefore at that point I must accept, logically just accept, that this is my situation and accept my destiny. That's it. This is what I must accept. But it shouldn't be giving up of hope. It should be an acceptance of your situation, and you recognize that there is really nothing that you can do. All right. The discussion was about defining, to understand other people, to be able to read and understand their nature. So for many reasons, for to protect yourself, but for to helping others, for helping people, if you know their nature, so then you know how to relate to them. Okay, choosing a spouse. So the thing is that you have to learn how to read a person's personality. The question is, what do you need? How do you learn to read a person's personality? What is necessary? What direction do you have to go to be able to read a person's personality? In all sciences, the first thing that you have to do is get the facts, then organize the facts, and then categorize them. Okay? Now, categorizing is what people call, they use the term theory, concept, svara. All these terms are used for categorization. But the first step that you have to have is observation. What do I mean? In other words, see, my five senses only sees, doesn't isolate different components of an object. That's the job of the mind. Okay? For instance, I see you only see, before the mind is working, all you see is an object. But once you isolate parts like a head, eyes, ears, hands, feet, that already is the mind working. That's already the mind working. And therefore, the thing is, it's not only to observe X, but it's to observe what is the act that really, in other words, what is the act, and what part of the act do I choose to be able to say this is the person's personality? In other words, observation is not just looking, but observation is already categorizing, putting into motion the exact a component in the person's action that is necessary to recognize the person's personality. Okay? Now, the truth is every science has to do this. Okay? And a person must train the mind to do this in some science. In Torah, most people train themselves in the area of Gemara and Halakha, which is a training for thinking, and then it could be applied to the human being. In the world in the outside world, they have different ways of training the mind. Some people use the dialogues of Plato. Some people use mathematics. Okay, there are different things for training on how to think. Okay? Now, there is a book written specially to be able to recognize and isolate the human emotions. The best book that I've seen is Mishlei, or Proverbs. Okay? I'd like to explain how it works. In every pasuk, in other words, starting with chapter 10, till about 29, practically each verse is a separate idea. You could connect the chapter, but you could also learn the verses separately. And every verse is set up between a Rasha and a Tzaddik. A Rasha is a wicked person, Tzaddik is a righteous, or it's set up, it's divided between the wise person and a fool. Okay? Difference is the wise person benefits himself, the fool destroys himself, the righteous benefits society, he sees the benefit in society, in helping society, and the Russia doesn't see any benefit in helping society, he wants to help himself at the expense of others, not recognizing that that's also a way of destroying the self. But basically every verse is divided into these two things, and a concept or a definition must always have a distinction and what they have in common. Okay? So in Mishle, what he has is always the distinction, and the commentaries usually clarify the distinction. Okay? Once you have the distinction, then one of the big problems is finding what the subject is that they leave up to you. So you have to work on finding the subject. Okay? Now, the way you learn about life, okay, from the from Mishle, works like this. The way he wrote it, there are different ways of reading it. King Solomon, okay? There are different ways of reading it, and that's why there's different commentaries. And so therefore, there's abstracting, learning to abstract from his words, the way he wrote, what he really means, to set it up that it makes sense. That type of abstraction is also a development to start isolating and finding different areas, you see? That's the way he wrote the book. Then once you have the verse set up, then it's a matter of defining, first of all, finding the subject, and what is the difference in the lifestyle, according to that verse, between either the wise and the fool, or the righteous and the wicked. And as you start going from verse to verse, it starts coming together, whole picture of the lifestyle of the wise and the righteous on one side, and the fool and the wicked on the other. That was the way the book was written. Okay, so that is the development. There has to be a certain point where you have to develop and train your ability for insights and interpretation. Okay. There are certain people, like Thomas said before, that naturally have a certain insight. You understand? They said, what's the difference between Einstein, who in physics, and Rav Chaim Brisk, who was one of the most abstract thinker of the time? So somebody said, who learned by both of them, he says that Einstein had a greater mind, but precision of, in other words, like he was ahead over Reb Chaim in brain power, but in precision, then Reb Chaim was head over heels over head over in precision, you see. So the thing is that Einstein naturally had insight, and but his precision was not well. But the Torah can't give you a better mind. What it can give you is a better precision, and train you to think if you don't have it on your own. There is a question like this in prayer in general. That the question is that if we hold that we're basically in the laws of nature, then how come we thank God for the particulars? Like, first of all, we thank God where he gives us bread. Well, he didn't give it to me. I mean, I'm not under God's personal supervision. You understand? And also, if something bad happens and I make it out of it, and, you know, I make it out of alive, there's a certain tefillah prayer that you say that you thank God for saving you. Something particular good, you have a tovah meitiv, that God did good for you. So the question is, on what basis, if we hold that everything is totally under the hashgacha, God's personal supervision, so then I understand that you always thank God for every thing. You wake up in the morning, you have to thank God. You breathe, you thank God. I mean, you know, if everything is under personal hashgacha. But if you hold that, we're in the laws of nature, so then why do we thank God in all these things? I have to know if God did it for me personally or not. On what basis do we thank God if God saved us? I mean, God didn't save us. It was a chancy thing, and we made it. So the answer is that all the laws of nature in general were made for the human's benefit. And most of the prayers are in we. Like we say, Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our God, our King. We say, Refa'enu, heal us. You understand? It's mostly in the plural. Plural means that it's not for me. It's based on the system that God created, a system that works well for the human. And therefore, even though it wasn't made specifically for me, but since I'm part of that system, so then you appreciate that the system works well for you. Now, there are two reasons why the system doesn't work well. Sometimes it doesn't work well, it's only in our mind, because we have a negative view of things. So therefore, it seems like the system is not working for us. So therefore, it's because of our own negative view. So that's only an error. You have to change how you view life. But there is a real case where sometimes the laws of nature, in certain situations, they shouldn't work for you and they do. In certain situations where they should work for you and they don't. And that is because wherever two good laws come together, there can be particular situations that it's not going to work out correctly the way you expect. In other words, there's some people that do bad things and they should get consequences and they don't. And in rare cases, there are times where you shouldn't get consequences and you do. That's because of the particulars that and the system is perfect, but the particulars do not always work out for us. Part of the system that the particulars don't always work out. Okay? But in general, the system does when the system works well, so then we thank God for the system that basically works well for us. Because we have so many laws of nature, and where so many, they meet each other in many different places, it is not unusual for an unusual thing to happen. In other words, where the particular doesn't work out according to certain rules, if there's only two rules, so then it'd be a rarity that the unusual case will come out. We have hundreds of rules, so therefore the unusual case, there are many unusual cases. So many unusual cases that you have unusual cases that happen, and it doesn't follow directly to the laws of nature because there might be two parts interfering with each other. That is not an unusual thing. Therefore, many people call a miracle where it's not based totally on unusual. So therefore I say that, yeah, a miracle is unusual, but you need more information to prove that it is a miracle. Okay, just because it's unusual doesn't make it a miracle. Okay, because unusual things, it's not unusual to have unusual things, that's why. So therefore you need more information to know when a thing is a miracle. Okay. Somebody gave a proof of a free will. He wanted to say like this: the fact that you discuss free will must be that you have free will. In other words, like this: if I hold that everything is determined, so then I can't change anything, so why discuss free will? I can't do anything. But the fact that I do discuss free will, so therefore I must hold from free will. This was the argument of a student in class, a proof of free will. Clarification of the question. That is this: if I don't hold from free will, but I'm discussing free will, the very fact that I'm discussing free will shows that I can make a change in me or not. Why am I discussing free will? Why even bother with the discussion if I cannot make any changes? Then why discuss it? Okay, the thing is like this: there are certain things that you see a lot of contradictions. Let's take being polite to another person. Now, you demand that I be polite to you, right? And you say, look, logically, I should be polite to you. But yet, you would walk out if the bell rang. You would walk out even though I'm in the middle of a statement. You would not think that you wouldn't say, well, I'm being impolite to Rabbi Moskowitz. It's okay for you to do that. Okay? In other words, you're pre-wired. You are already wired, whether it's from genes or from training, it's from childhood, to be contradictory in your life. In other words, you might hold with your mind that stealing is wrong, but yet you will take somebody's pen and use it without permission. Or you'll borrow money, a quarter, and you'll forget about it. You won't even think about it. You just totally forget about it. You don't hold it as stealing, and you don't hold the responsibility to remember that I owe somebody money. But if somebody borrowed money from you and they didn't pay it back, you'd say, boy, you're a big crook. So the thing is, you see in many, many cases, person is contradictory. Okay? Now, if I do not hold from free will, I don't hold that these two are contradictory. It's just that I'm pre-wired. For instance, I'll give you another contradiction. I must live according to free will. I must think things through as if I live from free will, right? But even if I don't hold from free will, I could hold not from free will, but practically I must live as if I do have free will, because, in other words, so I'm contradictory, because if I don't have free will, why do I think through choices? I can't think through choices. It's predestined what I'm going to do. The answer is that I hold that I'm pre-wired. I'm wired that way to think in choices, because all other animals that we see is for the purpose of survival. The human survival, the way this species operates, is based on that he must think things through, even though it's predestined what he's going to do. Okay? Whether you could change or not, he holds it's predestined that you are not the cause of your actions, but everything was the cause from beforehand. A person that does not hold from free will. Okay? Person that does not hold from free will means I cannot change anything. Everything is predestined. Even the fact that I'm going to have a discussion about free will, that is also predestined. If I'm raised in the house of thinkers, so I might ask these questions. If I'm not raised in the house, I won't ask these questions. All that is predestined based on everything is cause and effect, and that's what a person that holds non-free will is. If you hold from free will, then you would hold, you see, that there is a contradiction between my mind what I hold of manners and the way I act. I hold I'm acting incorrectly because my mind logically tells me that I should have manners. Or the Torah, or I know that the Torah is true and the Torah tells me I should not steal. So therefore I know I should not steal. And the fact that I act that I do steal, that's a contradictory. That's contradicting my philosophy. And I have the ability to change that. In other words, there is something in me which is not based on cause and effect. That's why we call it free will. Free will means that it's not based on cause and effect. It's different than all other things in the world. There's something in me that is different than all other things in the world, and I have the ability to change causes that already existed. That is the difficulty of free will, because free will is against cause and effect. The idea of free will is that I could change things that are cause and effect, that I'm obligated to act this way based on cause and effect. I have the free will to change that, not by some other cause. See, if I don't hold from free will, then I say I was predestined to question these ideas, and I'm predestined to come to different conclusions, but it's not that I have free choice. But we say, no, you are predestined not to live that way. But you can go against that. God gave you the ability to go against that, you see? So therefore, the fact that I discuss free will is not a proof for free will. I could be wired that way beforehand, whether from genes or from the parents training me, from society. I'm pre-wired to what my whole life, and there's no change. If you hold from free will, then you hold that there's a contradictory part, that there's two parts, and it's contradictory, but I do have the free will to go against what's preordained, what's pre-wired in me. I have the ability to change that. That is the difference between free will and not free will. Therefore, the way we live our lives, that we that hold from free will, because we even if we don't have a proof from the physical world of free will, we accept that the Torah, that God commanded us and he punishes us on these commands, that means we do have free will. Okay? So therefore, we have free will, so we hold that we are given these two parts, and we have the ability to change it. And there's nothing wrong in seeing the contradictions in your own life, that you think one thing and yet you act totally the opposite in certain situations, because there are two parts to you and yet you can't change it. But the first thing is you must be observant and recognize that I'm operating contradictory and that I have the ability to change it. That's the way we live our lives. They, on the other hand, whether I change it or not, has nothing to do with me. It's predestined whether I'll do it, so they don't have any responsibility to change their ways. Yes, from the physical world, I don't know if there's no proof from the physical world. I definitely don't have a proof in the physical world. The only reason why I accept free will is because of prophecy that God told us in the Torah that we will be punished if we don't keep the mitzvot. Now, if I'm pre-wired, if I'm wired a certain way and I can't change it, how can he punish me for something I can't change? So therefore, once we accept Torah, we must accept free will. Okay, so therefore that's why we accept free will. Okay, but this proof was from the physical world, that this guy was trying to bring a proof from the physical world, and I'm trying to show you that there is a difference in what the people that don't hold from free will, their very life and the way they look at life is very different from the person that does hold from free will. It's two different lifestyles, and what responsibilities I have if I hold from free will, and what responsibilities I don't have if I don't hold some free will. That's what we're trying to get across here. Now, since free will is based on what you know about reality, and the you have a choice to live the life of the mind and to undo the parts of you that look at life irrationally, what about people that are raised in a totally superstitious society, and they cannot get out of it? They don't have anybody to show them. I mean, Abraham was extremely unusual, where he lived in a society of idolatry and superstition, and he was able to pull out. He's a unique person. But there are people that don't have that ability. Does everybody have free will? The answer is, in my view, is that everybody has the components in him of free will, but he needs a certain situation to bring it out. And not everybody, in other words, in certain societies, even in non-Jewish societies, it's easier to bring out. They're like, let's say, in a society like Greek society, where they were built on the world of ideas, and there was people that started discussing justice and righteousness. There you could have a freedom where the society could choose to live a righteous life or an unrighteous life, and freedom and the free will is brought out. But if you're raised in a totally superstitious society, it's possible in that situation the people did not have, in other words, that in their created form they have free will, but the way they were raised, it was totally closed, and it could be you can't bring them out. Like, there's certain people that were raised by animals, their cases, and they're brought out, and they cannot develop, since they were raised by animals, they cannot develop beyond a certain age. They tried to help them develop. They couldn't really totally get into society. They don't have free will. Their free will, by the way they were raised, is lost. You see, it's not that they didn't have free will. It's the situation that they're raised in. It's close to them, based on society. Based on the society or the way they were raised. As a human being, they have free will, but from the way they were raised, it was taken from them at a very young age. You understand? I'll give you an example. If you look at kids ask questions about life. Like, they'll ask, why the sun doesn't fall, or why the moon doesn't fall. People look at them as crazy. They laugh, right, as a joke. Now, that laughter teaches the child that he doesn't know why. I mean, the parent probably, or the people that laugh, can't answer the question. It has to do with physics, so they can't answer the question. But the child is learning from an early age that you can't question, and that the society will laugh at you, and somehow that's a stupid thing to do. Then they go to school and they get teachers that also don't answer questions. So the thing is that they go to school and they get a teacher that says they don't want them to answer questions, and they put them down for asking questions. You see? Now, they could lose their free will by virtue of this education or from the society. So therefore, your free will can be taken away from the society that you're raised in, or from your individual parents or education that you get. Your free will can be taken away from you. But as a human being, every human being has that capacity of free will, but based on the way you were raised, that free will can be taken away from you. In other words, another case, let's say a person, in other words, he lives his life based on his personality, not on free will. He'll be guided by only one part of him in his life. However his personality came out, he will always make decisions based on that, but he cannot make a decision based on his mind. Can't make a decision based on his mind. That's the reason somebody doesn't have an IQ to become a doctor. So that's it. That's not one of his choices. He can't become a doctor. So he has to live life based on his abilities. Now, certain people, their ability of free will is taken away from based on the society. based on their education, it's taken away. Okay? So therefore, that they must live by their emotions, by their personality. I'm not saying that the other part, the mental part, to be able to make decisions on the mental part is not there anymore. It's just taken away by virtue of the way you were raised. Okay? Or I'll give you another example. Let's say, for instance, a person is raised and he's given a very big ego, and he can't see any faults in himself. He's raised in such a way that he can't tolerate faults. He can't see a fault. That guy can never change, because free will means I have to first recognize that I'm in contradiction and my emotions is doing stupid things, and then I can correct it. But if I don't have the ability to see that I have, that I'm doing things incorrectly, I can't see that, so then that guy has lost his free will too. It doesn't mean he doesn't have, as the species he's created, with the ability to have free will, but the personality becomes so powerful, that part of him that he was raised in, personality part, becomes so powerful that it can't override, I mean that the mental part that would have the free will to think to counteract the personality is overridden, and so therefore it can't operate. Doesn't mean he never had it. As a species, we have it, but the fact is that it's taken away by virtue of the by virtue of our personality. So therefore, you must have that ability to see ideas. Avram was unique that nobody taught him, and on his own he was able to bring out, even though he lived in a idolatrous and superstitious society, he still was able to have that free will. That is greatness. He was still be able to become an independent thinker and to make decisions based on his free will. That was a unique person. That's why he's so great beyond any other person, because nobody else has that. Very rare that you have that situation, that you come into that situation and you have your free will, and then you get out of it, making a decision against your society. That's a unique thing.